VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, welcome to The Ruck. In yet another triumph for this podcast, here we are, 2 days after Saracen's win in Europe, and I've got two of the all-time great Fez heads with me today. They're chuckling. Are Saracens still Fez heads anyway? I don't know. I was in Newcastle for the weekend and I didn't see a Fez, no shaking of heads.
Anyway, they're still there.
There are a few, yeah, there are a few.
They call themselves the Fez boys, don't
they? Yeah, they do.
I never know
they
why
do.
They always get called Fez heads. Right, Fez boys.
These are the dulcet tones of, well, I'm Owen Slot and I'm joined by Mark Evans, one of our favourites on this show, all-round egghead, leading coach and administrator in the game, and also the man, boss, head coach, who took Saracens into the professional era. So can we say, Mark, that you recruited Nigel Ray and are therefore responsible for everything that's happened ever since?
I was at the very first meeting when we met Nigel, but no, I wouldn't claim that for a second.
That's unlike
well,
you.
Well, it was Nigel,
how very
modest. The Sultan of Brunei, I seem to remember.
Yes,
he was courted.
Yes, perhaps that might have not been a good call 20 years on.
I don't know if you're being serious. Did you actually...
No, they literally contacted the Sultan of Brunei. There's a letter where he very politely declines to come and join them at Bramley Road.
The Sultan said no?
Yeah, I can't believe it.
The Sultan said no.
Staggering,
and
really.
And Nigel manfully stepped into the breach.
Oh, well, not a bad runner-up, anyway. The other voice you've just been heard who hasn't had an introduction yet, apologies, is author, rugby journalist and Saracens biographer Mike Aylwin, still living off the windfall of his epic bonk buster published in 1999, The Red and the Black, Glory and Uncertainty at Saracens.
I googled it a couple of years ago and I think there was a copy available on the internet somewhere for £600. So if anyone...
It's a great book.
£600?
Something like that. I think they're quite hard to come by.
It was limited edition.
It was a fairly limited edition. I haven't retired off the proceeds.
It's a good read, though. If you can ever get hold of one, I must admit. Although apparently I smirk all the time. I wasn't aware of that until Michael.
Sorry, read. Oh, that's beastly.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
yeah,
you've got to be brutally honest if these books are going to fly.
We met
at the launch of an obscure magazine, no longer with us, called Inside Rugby. Mm. And you spent most of the evening chatting up my girlfriend at the time.
Did I?
Mm.
Well, there we are, man of taste,
not
as
sure
ever.
If I've ever mentioned that before.
No, I don't you have.
And is that now Mrs. Aylwin?
No, there's another Mrs. Aylwin.
So Mark just drove her off completely.
I clung on to her for a little while, but she never quite got over the meeting with
okay.
Mark.
Okay, all right. Probably shouldn't go any
no,
further.
I think
probably
saying,
not. No, probably not.
Mike, that's 20 years ago now. Would you say that your experience of being an insider with Saracens for a season?
2 years.
2 years?
Yeah.
Those can be. That's an interesting thing to do as a writer. You can go both ways. You can warm to your subject, or you can feel very pleased to get out at the end of it.
I was mid-20s at the time. I did everything but take to the field with them. Basically, I trained with them. I was in the changing room during the match, or half time. Sat with the coaches during the match. So it was amazing. I got the in from my mate from university, Matt Singer, who turned pro.
Oh yeah.
And he had the idea, and we got permission off Nigel, and I was allowed to go everywhere basically and see everything. And it was incredible for somebody just out of university to go almost straight into that as his first experience of not just sports journalism but rugby up close and personal.
So would you have been watching the final on Saturday with a fez upon your bonce?
I would not have been wearing a fez on my bonce, but I'd have been dressed up to look much like Mark Evans at the time. Oh, I went to the 98 Bidders Cup final
In a Saracen's tracksuit?
In a Saracen's suit and right. tie.
So you say you feel, so you do feel a great deal of warmth for the club then? Or
It was a long time ago. I mean, yeah. I certainly... Yeah, you get sucked into it. You definitely want them to win back then, partly because you want your book to do well. but, I mean, now... Well, I mean, I go to Saracens a lot because it's a London club and I live in London and, you know, cover rugby in and around London. But I don't feel any particular allegiance to them anymore. I mean,
all right, so this is going to be a dispassionate deconstruction of the European champions. So, they won on Saturday. I think probably everyone who's listening might have worked that out.
Yes.
They were fairly awesome on Saturday. I went away from that hugely impressed, wondering what's going to stop them. Because I can't receive very much out of that can.
These things just don't. Like, I mean, it does seem to me as if every year, not every year, but every time we get a team, we had it with Toulon, who won three in a row. We had it with Leinster. We've got it with Saracens now. There is a tendency of us, all of us, to say, "Is this the greatest team ever?" And there's no doubt they are a pretty serious outfit. And I think rugby is getting, well, as we all know, it's getting more and more intense. So in order to prevail, you have to be probably better than the team that dominated 5 years ago and so on, but none of these dynasties last forever.
To be fair, if you dug out my report on last year's final, I did ask almost exactly the same question.
Will anyone ever beat Leinster?
Yeah. And Leinster are unstoppable. Yeah, yeah. They're here
for decades. We do have a tendency to do that. Yeah, no, press it's part of the narrative. And
it's a noble profession, but sometimes we over-egg things.
I don't think they're finished yet. I think they've got a lot more trophies in them. And I think if the game stays structured the way it is and refereed the way it is, it's quite hard to see too many teams in Europe challenging the two that played on Saturday. I wouldn't write Leinster off.
No.
Again, you know. They've played them four times in the Heineken. That's the first time Saracens have won. And they won comfortably. But Leinster, they will come again. I've no doubt about that whatsoever.
But
I think the real question is there another... Are there another couple? Because for the game, and I can say this now as I've sort of... You know, because I'm not attached to any particular team. What we don't really want is 5 years of Leinster v Saracens. And can you win another way? Because they play so similarly. I had a really interesting... Just Saracens were better at it. I had a really interesting chat with Wayne Barnes after the game, and he was of the view, and I think I tend to share it, that says the team that might beat those two, but they might get thumped as well, are the sort of... The offloading La Rochelle, Clermont.
I was going to say, it was Friday teams. A glimpse of.
I think what you're saying is that aesthetically we much prefer watching the Friday night game. can you win the big titles
yeah. playing any other way than the big power game? I don't know.
When you're up against a Saracens or indeed a Leicester who are playing as well as that. You know, if you can execute that game, then offload as much as you want. But
well, look, let's not try and suggest that Clermont can't play the power game, because by God,
they've got
enough heavy artillery to play it any which way. And I think we can underestimate Saracen's subtlety. I know, obviously, the trump card ends up someone like Billy Vunipola or Will Skelton smashing through. But you know, the way they finished that try at the end of the first half was absolutely magical, I thought. I mean, the ability to spot the opportunity to miss out Alex Good, who was standing in at fly half, go straight to Farrell, and then Farrell's hands to put away Maitland.
Having sucked in the defence, and then, as you say, they moved it very, very well.
And Jordan Lama, in a way, Liam Williams did the same thing at the start of the second half, or early in the second half, where he took a gamble and went in hard on the pivot, and not only tackled him, but won the ball at turnover.
Was that the turnover when he was lying down?
was it?
Like, well, he definitely had both knees on the ground. Right, I suspect both hips possibly, as well. But anyway, it was a
but Jordan Lama sort of tried to do the same thing when Farrell got the ball away and didn't really need to. I mean, he could have stayed out on Maitland. So Saracens were obviously helped in that regard a little bit. But, you know, still the skill, the sleight of hand to finish it off was something special. And I think Saracens can play, you know, the offloading game, if we like.
Oh, they can, but not at the very, very big...
I think what you're saying is matches. Right, Mark, is it, compared to the Saracens of 4 years ago or so, which I found not a great, particularly enjoyable view, you know, they can really entertain now. But your point is that when it actually comes to the summit, then that is the game they can play.
Leinster. But at when the real stuff's on the line, we get this very, very. I mean, the line speed on Saturday of Saracens was just extraordinary. And again, you know, I for a while, because I know if Stephen Jones was here, he'd say, "Yeah, but they're offside. They're not.
That's
the
yeah.
They're not." I mean, I watched it. I stopped watching it for the game for a bit and just watched the Saracens line come up, because Leinster were going through one of their sort of 15 phases going nowhere bits that happens against a really good defence. That's not a criticism of Leinster. They were trying all sorts. But the line speed of the first five is just extraordinary.
I think Wayne Barnes has been on this very podcast to put Steve in his place on this.
I think he has.
Actually, if you pause the moment, not always, but as often as not, they are onside. They're just bloody quick. They rush
and they're all quick.
And it all looks as if, by the time the ball's got to 10, they've already...
It does look as if. I don't like to think of Jonesy taking Saracens down for being offside or anything.
No, he
admires the mighty Saracens.
He does, a great deal, and with good reason.
Is the double an inevitability now?
I think so. Look, you can never obviously rule out an off day or somebody being inspired, but
yellow or a red card or something. Stuff like that happens, obviously.
But I mean, really, you know, last year they had that. Saracens had that strange wobble around the middle of the season where Claremont, among other teams, smashed them at home. And that put them on the back foot, and they qualified for an away quarter final at Leinster, which came pretty much straight after the Six Nations.
It's 2 weeks after.
So all the momentum with the Irish, generally. They'd won the Grand Slam, and Leinster were looking $1 million. And that was a journey too far. But really, Saracens were probably the second best team in Europe at that point. They could have got to a final if they hadn't.
The rest of the season, this year they'd be able to manage their team so well, haven't they?
Yeah.
So this weekend's almost a sort of a rest week for the team.
Yeah, it is.
Totally.
And their squad's so deep.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, everyone's... we've almost forgotten both their first choice props didn't make the first quarter.
Yeah.
I mean, no one's even mentioned it. No, I don't mean today. I mean, but just the commentary over the weekend. No, it's almost been forgotten. I mean, Mark McCall, to his credit, highlighted it. But it is almost as, you just didn't notice, did you?
If you bring off
your tight end and you bring on Vincent Cock, a tight end springbok.
It must have been a contentious selection in the first place not to pick him.
True.
But, I mean, somebody like Barrington is, you know... One would have gone not very long ago. A lot of people probably still do go when they say Richard Barrington, but what a game he had. And that's what they're so good at, is you know, taking these... People complain about the salary cap and so on and so forth, but they are superb at taking these unknown people and turning them into people who can slot in
Will Skelton. He wasn't an unknown, obviously, but wow, have they done a great job on him.
I mean, he looks a different player.
Yeah.
And
he looks so happy as well, doesn't he?
That was a terrific bit of recruitment.
Yeah.
You know, they recruited well as well. People, I mean, I know their academy's good, you know, after a sort of decade when it was really not very good at all. But the last 10 years, they've They've really been good at that.
And someone like Alex Lazowski as well, you know. He was a little known bit part at Walsall.
No, he went to Leeds. There was a lot of competition for Lazowski. Right.
He wasn't an England international.
Oh no, he was came out of uni. No, he was young. You know, and they've Liam Williams has played really, really well.
Oh god,
you know, and he is a world class player.
Yeah, I thought he was quite good before he went. Actually,
exactly. but I'm saying they've recruited well. Yeah. I don't think that's a development story. That's a recruitment story. Yeah. And I mean, Elliot Daly's a recruitment story.
That is a recruitment story, which we won't get into now.
There's two world class players there that are being added, and you know, but.
And then the best of the lot, Alex Good, in between.
The one that everyone forgets, Duncan Taylor's not fit.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Who I think is one of the best centres in Europe.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not played all year.
Yeah. But that's, you know, if you're looking at the team going, what's going to come of age? What's going to be taken away from the team soon? Well,
not much.
At some point, Brad Barrett is going to be, I mean, he's 33 in the summer. But what you're saying, you've got Duncan Taylor, if he's ever fit, who can.
What about, and they got this young boy Malins is going to be a sensational player. Yeah. Now
if he stays,
because he must be going and looking. Well, hold on a minute.
Yeah.
I thought that 13 shirt or 12 that was going to, and now it's looking a lot more crowded.
It's very rare that people leave, though, isn't it?
Not often. Nathan Earl. Did, one or two? No, because it's a really good club, and I think I think players enjoy being there. But I don't think it's quite so much. Are Saracens going to get weaker anytime soon? And no, in the others, is the traditional cycle going to turn? I think it's more a question of are enough clubs going to step up? You know, can Toulouse, who in my book were the most attractive team this year in the Heineken, who beat Leinster at home but didn't really fire a shot away. They're a very young side. Might they be the team? You know, can Exeter translate their domestic form over two competitions? That's the challenge.
The French teams at the start of the season, I would have said Racing would
have been the one. I still think Racing could give Saracens a really tight game. So, you know, I don't think it's like a... I think Saracens will be there or thereabouts for a long time. It doesn't mean they're going to win everything.
I mean, the question is in the context of England. I mean, I know we always talk about Exeter and Saracens being so far ahead of the rest, but actually, Saracens are significantly further ahead than Exeter. I mean, they comprehensively beat them in the final last year. And the year before that, again, juggling so many balls.
Yeah, that was.
You know, they won in the Europe. They were comfortably the best team in Europe, which means, you know, England, so far, is still in Europe. That means they're the best team in England as well. And they lost at Exeter in fairly extraordinary circumstances. The week after they'd won, you know.
Yeah.
And that is
so
tough.
They were the best team in England then as well, by some distance, really.
So you're awarding them the 2017 Premiership title as well?
Well, that's not within my power, Slotty.
I think we're arguing that the team who wins the Premiership is not always the best team. And that's, you know.
I mean, I think they are. There's daylight between them and everybody else in
England. Okay, just one more comment on the European final. So it has been hailed as one of the if not the most sort of highest quality club games ever, amazing contests, etc. I went away feeling all those things, but is there a part in there where we're thinking, is that actually the rugby that we want to see at the summit of the game? It's obvious what we're saying. Friday night was a different type of rugby, Claremont and La Rochelle, and to most eyes, it was far more entertaining.
Well, I don't have much truck with this idea that it does seem to have some purchase that rugby is an awful game to watch now, or it's not as good as it used to be back in the glory days. For our book, I did a certain amount of research which involved sitting through the second and fourth tests of the 71 Lions tour in New Zealand. One of the most legendary episodes in rugby history. And I can tell you, it was awful. I mean, it really made me quite angry. Not because, look, they were amateurs.
Mike, can you now leave the room? Because we're not actually going to...
He made me watch it after that.
What makes me angry is this idea that people think rugby was so much better back then. It was awful. There were over 100 set pieces in both matches. And there were the same, roughly, give or take the odd tackle, number of tackles. The same number of tackles as there are set pieces. Just think about that for a minute. Over 50 scrums. Ball being dropped right, left and centre. I mean, it was a shambles.
No defence.
And we all say, oh, well, you know, the defence is killing the game. Well, actually, it's not. It was just really annoying, the fact that they just didn't come up and put any pressure on the...
Well, they just waited for attacks to arrive at their doorstep.
It was just no...
After fashion, yeah. It's worth... Look, no, it's on YouTube if you want to go and... Listeners, if you want to go and look...
The second test is a bit better.
The fourth test, it's an education.
So... Rugby, compared to that now, is it is a different sport practically, and it is so much the better. But it is undeniably becoming more and more intense, steadily so. And that game today did represent... I've been doing some tackle counts of my own with a special app on my phone because I'm a bit... concerned about some of the figures that are coming out of these official tackle counts and how much it's gone through the roof in the last 10 years.
Mike, so special stats.
Special stats.
Elwyn Stats Centre.
Ones that he's confident in.
And the game that was credited with the most tackles in the Six Nations this year was Scotland-Wales, and the official stats have it at 364 tackles. I did a count whereby a tackle was every time a ball carrier was stopped. It won't be exactly accurate, but pretty accurate, and there's a lot of question marks over what constitutes a tackle, which is part of the problem. Anyway, I had that game and the Ireland-England game at about 250 tackles. I did the same on Sunday morning for the game on Saturday, and it was 315. So it was another level from the Six Nations. And that is another question that terrifies, and we'll probably get on to all of this, but, you know, where is the game going to go next? What's going to lead it? And the fear of many in world rugby is that the clubs are going to take over. And you could make a case that Leinster and Saracens would win the Six Nations.
How many tackles in those 71 Lions tests-ish?
100. Just over 100.
Mm. 100. So that's over three times.
Yeah.
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 I mean, Mike's a bit more positive than me in the sense that...
Thank goodness.
you know, he and he's right. I mean, if you go back and look at the games that people of my advanced years grew up with, that you have got this... halo of myth around them, they really aren't very good. Okay, there are some brilliant bits.
Well, yeah, I guess that is true.
There are some brilliant bits.
Well, and don't show me the rest. Brought up to see short clip highlights.
Yeah, 73 bar bars, Phil Bennett, and I get all that.
But the rest of the game wasn't like that.
Terrible. But where I am concerned is twofold, really. It is becoming, if it's not already become, almost entirely a power-based game. So if you are not a very, very powerful athlete of whatever height or weight, you can't really play it at this level because you will be a weak link in the defensive line, and every time you carry the ball, you get put 5 yards backwards. You know, I mean, I think what James Haskell had to say on his retirement was really interesting about how power is now everything. Mm. And to that degree, we're on a line towards American football. That in itself concerns me for a whole load of participation reasons and whatever, but it's not my concern. My biggest concern is this. Rugby union was always about possession going from one team to the other fairly quickly and often.
Yeah.
We call it turnovers, but, you know, back in the day, you weren't guaranteed to win your own scrum ball. you certainly weren't guaranteed to win your own line-out ball. Nobody could be lifted. It was the line-outs are hilarious. Go back and watch them. It's just an education. And the ruck was like a Wild West with the kicking and the gouging and God knows who. Sometimes you went with the ball and sometimes you didn't. You didn't come out with it quite often. So there was this constant yo-yoing of possession that brought a lot of interest and sort of uncertainty. Light and shade and uncertainty about the game. Now, and it's not something that other codes haven't had to wrestle with, now you can have one team holding on to the ball for 4, 5, 6 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, from when they eventually get it back.
And these are the teams who are top of the...
And they are the best teams because you're controlling possession and you're controlling territory and it's, you know, and they're also, though the teams who are good at that are also very, very comfortable without the ball. So what don't you get? What's gone from the game to a significant degree? Very few line breaks at the highest level.
Uh-huh.
Very few turnovers of possession. Fewer than there were even 10 years ago.
Mm.
And very little tactical kicking. Not completely disappeared, and certainly in lower games, you see loads of tactical kicking lower down the Premiership and all, but the really big events, the World Cup finals, the Heineken Cups, those, the very top level, a team gets hold of the ball and they will look after it for a long, 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 long time, and eventually they'll kick it to win it back. So the idea of drilling it for the corner, push behind the line, all those sort of nuances, I'm not saying they're gone, but they are far, far fewer than they were.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I suppose, that concerns me more than the players are much fitter, they cover a lot more ground, they're much more powerful, etc., etc.
Should we just explain sort of roughly where we're going to poor listeners? Who,
What are they talking about?
They're not in on this master plan that I was just going to gently lob in. So as I said, you two are something of a double act, and that is because you are writing a book. Out in September, and your book is called
Unholy Union, When Rugby Collided with the Modern World.
Right, and this is the sort of thing that I find really interesting.
Hope you're not on your own.
Yeah, for your sakes, I hope that's not the case. But can you explain what is this unholy union all about?
I'd say there are two major themes running through the book. The first one is we put forward the idea that every sport, every professional sport, or even serious amateur sports, reaches a point in time whereby it either kicks on and really prospers or flatlines and goes into something of a long-term decline.
Yeah.
For a whole host of reasons. And there's lots of examples over the world where you can show this. And our book is nothing if it isn't a claim that rugby worldwide is at that point now, and that we have reached a tipping point.
The point where it takes off or starts to slide.
Yes, yes. And I suppose that's the sort of one, that's one theme running through the book, I suppose. And a lot of it is about, you know, which is it likely to be and what are the forces pushing it in one direction, what are the forces pushing it in another. So it covers a whole load of stuff from concussion through to the drift of players to the Northern Hemisphere, through to can you restructure the game, to
participation.
It's pretty wide ranging.
Everything
we talk about all the time, it's trying to bring that into a synthesis and analyze where the trends, based on, you know, hard data, both financially and injuries and participation, and also tentatively towards the end to make some suggestions about how it might get on the right track.
We're better at criticising than making constructive suggestions.
It's really difficult.
Because it is difficult.
This is one thing I get sometimes when I write a column in the Times addressing some of these situations.
You
might say, concussion's terrible and the game's got a problem, or The economics of the game means all the best players from the Southern Hemisphere come to the North, and all these things are a big threat to the game. And then typically the comments underneath go, well, so it's very well to point that out, but what are you actually suggesting we do about it?
I think,
and I try to come up with suggestions.
I'll come back to the second theme in a minute, but on that point, it's a very, very good point. I don't think it's so much that we don't think we can come up with what we think needs to be done. I think that you can make a pretty good stab at that. Whether you think it can be done, given the structures and the governance of the game, that we're much more less optimistic about.
All right, so let's say that tomorrow Bill Beaumont decides he doesn't want to be chairman of World Rugby anymore and Brett Gosper prefers golf.
Yeah.
So you two are chairman and chief executive of World Rugby.
We are in fantasy land.
And you can do what you fancy. Mm. What's the solutions? How do you make rugby take off rather than decline?
Does rugby actually want to grow, shall we call it? And we ask that question a lot throughout the book, and not in a sort of flippant, cynical way.
Because we both love it.
Genuine question. Does rugby just entrench, focus on what it knows and who it knows? You know, if China want to take on rugby, great, let them find their own way, all that sort of stuff. Does rugby focus on what it already has? Or does rugby try to expand? And if it's the latter, then strategically, it's fairly obvious, Japan and America are the most important points of interest. But either way, whether Japan and America ever take off or whether they don't, the dynamic for a lot of the countries that we would now call, we hate the phrase, tier one, the implications are not healthy for a lot of them, whatever happens. I mean, if Japan and America join the party, you know, how tenuous will the grip of your Scotlands, your Wales, your Australians, even your New Zealand on, you know, the status quo? So the status quo currently is basic. The tier one nations have 3 votes each. That's 60% of world rugby's vote.
So they can vote to protect themselves.
Yeah, tier one nations if you run are the game, not in world rugby. Let's make that very, very clear.
So poor old Brett Gosper and his executive, I mean, they genuinely want to grow the game and they do fantastic missionary work all around the world to do it. But does it actually mean anything when the guys in the council with the important votes, you know, would Scotland want rugby to take off in Japan? Because what does that mean for Scotland? You know, that's why they're
against promotion relegation in Six Nations, isn't it?
Scotland
doesn't want rugby to take off in Georgia, really.
Yeah.
I mean,
they're on the fringes of an economic monster, which is England and France, which is the centre of gravity of rugby. And rugby's only real prospect now to stop that imploding, a sort of black hole sucking all the resources into it, is if there are alternative centres of gravity, namely Japan and America, the most obvious and realistic options in the near future. But even if you do establish centres of gravity there as well, what are the implications for your Scotlands? All of those.
So what do you think, Mark? Are you buying a flat in Tokyo and a little hole in Las Vegas or something?
I wouldn't choose Las Vegas, but, you know, maybe North Cal. I think that drives us to the second theme that we were of the book, which is that, and Michael, being the outstanding writer that he is, sparing his blushes, but he really is, came up with a great image for this, which was, and it's the subline of the book, which is rugby. What was it? What do we call it?
Rugby collided with the modern.
That's right, and that. So rugby union, and I do say union, in 1895 when the split with league, sort of almost got frozen in aspic. That's not to say the game didn't change, it didn't grow, of course it did, but nothing really changed until the game went pro.
Yeah.
And so rugby was sort of held back. It lost 100 years. It lost 100 years worth of opportunity and dealing with issues that other sports like football and American football and Aussie rules dealt with. We hardly dealt with any of them. Then suddenly in 1996, the slingshot gets released and we miss the 20th century and rocket into the 21st. You know, it shouldn't be a surprise that we've got a few issues. But and again, that's really what the book is about. So we've still got a game that if you genuinely do want it to go globally, and I know that can be a bit glib, then it has to be governed globally. I mean, FIFA, for we make the comparison. Yeah. FIFA, for all its faults, you know, and I know we get really on our sort of rather snobby in rugby about our football, you know. What you mean the most popular game in the world, played in 212 countries, run by FIFA, who genuinely do have clout, right, and their regional organisations like UEFA, they have 212 countries with 212 votes.
Yeah, you know, one country, one vote.
One country, one vote. Doesn't matter whether you're the tiniest little Cook Islander FA, you get the same vote as Germany. Now, that's got its challenges too, and I'm not saying that's the model we should necessarily copy by any means. But if you genuinely want to take a global view, it's very, very difficult when your constitution, if you will, is set up to reflect a small number of traditional powerhouses.
Yeah.
And then you come back to the question Mike raised earlier, does rugby union really want to grow?
But then Mike sort of answered that with another question, which is, if it does grow, if you do make Japan and America the great big centres of world rugby, then you're threatening
Either way,
your traditional powers.
I think you're threatening them less, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, I think the threat's basically there anyway, because if you carry on, here's one of the, hopefully, you know, thesis that we put forward that has some merit. It's if you carry on as you are, I mean, again, the great image, the black hole of England and France will just suck and continue. You know, there's a reason why World Rugby and Gus Piscio and people are desperately trying to get some kind of global solution. It's because they're trying to pump some money in, some incremental, is that word again, some incremental revenue into some tier one countries that are looking a bit shaky, and we all know the ones that are, and two of them are looking shaky for reasons nothing to do with rugby, South Africa and Argentina. You know,
domestic economy.
They're disputed, yes, exactly, and geopolitics. But
we don't do enough geopolitics on this.
That's true.
So thank you for that.
You know, it's there's, and then there's rugby reasons in places like Wales and Australia. Well, there's four before you've even really had to think too hard about it.
Do you think you two are going to be employed as consultants after this?
No. I would think it highly unlikely.
Brett, I know Brett what listens every week.
Does he?
Yeah.
He's an avid listener.
He lives in Wimbledon, lives down the road from me.
Yeah.
So I welcome his...
Look, I think
you can knock on my door anytime.
There's people in World Rugby who recognise these trends. This is not Nobel Prize winning stuff. You know,
can we give this conversation can we move from the macro view to the micro view? Just because it's topical, and we won't do a lot on it because I don't know. Maybe the demand is to do lots on it, but we're running out of time. More topically, the RFU board meets on Wednesday, and I suspect that they're going to be discussing, though it's not confirmed yet, whether the Premiership expands from 12 to 13 teams, stops traditional promotion relegation, has an end of season playoff between the bottom team in the Prem and the top in the Championship. That, I think, is where a very long debate about promotion relegation is going to end up. You rugby consultants, do you think this is smart or not?
It has taken me quite a while, like with all of us, I think, to change our minds on this. But now it is just so obvious that relegation and promotion has to end, as far as I'm concerned. And we were discussing earlier the farce that is the fact that we had this incredible weekend in Newcastle over the weekend, and you know, a lot of new people would have been introduced, not to the game, but they will have gone.
30% of the crowd were from the northeast.
Right.
Right. And so all those new people are coming through the gate.
Right, where can I get me more of this next season? Ah, sorry, Newcastle have gone. There is no club servicing.
Hang on
the
15
top.
Months through, think they'll be back. Yeah.
There's no club in the top quarter of the country, north of Manchester.
No Premiership club.
No Premiership club, sorry.
Yeah.
And that strategically is a disaster for English rugby. And it shouldn't be allowed to happen. And next season, what if... Well, next season, London Irish put together an incredible squad. They very like... Well, could they quite possibly up. Not yeah. go down. They're then going to move to West London, where Harlequins already are. Then you could even have... If Newcastle don't come back up, you could have Ealing coming up. And you could have someone like Leicester going down. Leicester with 20,000 people at a match. Ealing have the second lowest attendance in the Championship.
Average 900,000.
Oh,
they've gone up this season.
They could come up. You could have three clubs in each other's pockets, one of whom, I mean, you wouldn't even call it a cult following. I mean, it's not a professional... it is professional, of course it is, but it's not a commercial proposition at this point. It won't be if they stay where they are, which is...
Do you think minimum standards in the Premiership, you should have a minimum average crowd? I mean, that would be one way...
Well, I do, yeah. I think, I mean, well, it's how do you enforce that? But
well, you just look at their crowd, and I mean, you're the stats man. You can do it in 2 seconds.
I mean, it hasn't taken me 20 years to come to the view. I've held this view since...
Yeah, well, I remember this was a live discussion.
Mike and I first met in 1997. I held this view then.
I think we can rewind to a few other podcast episodes
yes,
where you have espoused that
view. It goes
a
lot earlier than that. And I would say that... You know, we can get very... I know we're bringing it down to the micro, to England, and actually, for all its problems, and there are major problems in like there always will be, there are major problems in English football. Doesn't mean it's not successful, you know. There's no kind of sort of mythical state you get to where there are all the issues are resolved. Life isn't like that. I mean, English rugby, along with French rugby, although I did hear over the weekend some people being very concerned about French rugby participation wise, but I don't know enough about it that with French win the Football World Cup and all the rest of it. And that really would be a challenge. That's the biggest market, rugby market in the world. If that starts to shrink, then there really are some issues. But English rugby has got some very, very strong fundamentals. And then we can agonise about promotion, relegation. You know, 45 million collective loss amongst the Premiership clubs this year, up from 31 the year before. You know, there are some things to fix here. But English rugby fundamentally is a big market with a lot of clubs and quite a lot of followers. There are other countries in Tier 1 that are in a much, much more precarious state than that. And once you get beyond Tier 1, you have the whole issue of how do we underpin the Tier 1 countries that we can't afford to lose, but have enough resource, which basically means money, left over to invest in the Tier 2 countries that we think genuinely could become Tier 1 countries. And I know this sounds incredibly manipulative, but Georgia's only got 3 million people, and Japan's got over 100 million people. I know where I'd invest my money.
But this is the poignant question. I mean, the two collections of islands in the Pacific, Japan, and then, of course, our beloved Pacific Island nations, Fiji, Tonga.
Of which there is a whole chapter in the book, which is a whole story on its own.
Oh, stop it. I just can't wait now.
But, you know, you've got one cut. The number of registered players in Tonga. Now, we discuss how much we can trust these figures from World Rugby.
Well,
but anyway,
I know that you've done your own stats.
The number of... I haven't counted the registered players in Tonga. It's a quarter of the population of Tonga. Fiji, if you take the half that is native Fijian, as opposed to nearly half the population of Fiji is Indian, came in the 19th century.
They don't really play rugby.
But if you take the half of Fiji that does play rugby, their registered number of players is about a fifth
of the total population. It's about 100,000.
Yeah, it is about... Because Japan and Fiji have the same number of registered players, roughly. Japan is a nation of 125 million. Fiji is a nation... The half that play rugby is half a million. Now, rugby is totally saturated in the Pacific Islands. There is no prospect for any growth there whatsoever. So you turn your back. This is economics. There's nothing sinister about this, or it's a simple logical sequence. You end up turning your back on the nations that adore rugby, that have grown up, they've given rugby, the rugby world, more than any other nations. You turn your back on them because it's just not economically sensible to invest any more in there, and you end up going for this other.
You just nailed another problem rather than a solution there.
I think you've lost your job
as chief executive.
It's a tragedy. It's too strong, but it's a travesty that this happens, but it is inevitable. Japan couldn't care less about rugby, relatively speaking, but look at the numbers. Of course, you end up going down that road. That's professionalism.
Unholy Union. When's it out? September?
September, yes. First.
Oh, just in time for the World Cup.
Obviously. Just in time for the World Cup.
God, how did you time that? That's very clever of you.
I think the publisher insisted from memory.
That's where Mike puts his final.
But I mean, what we're trying to do, you know, we're realistic. We just like to move the agenda, or at least help to shape the agenda. We keep coming back to it, you know. We believe, and now we sound like sort of almost like a statement of faith, that the game, which we both have loved for decades, is at a tipping point, and it could go either way.
Okay, thanks. I mean, I think it's fascinating, and I completely agree with you in that I have felt in the 5 years I've been rugby correspondent at this newspaper that these issues are piling up, and that. So that they can't just carry on being loaded like this. There's a solution, and as you say, it could work or it could not.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Premiership weekend, the big issue is who's going to finish fourth and qualify for the semi-finals. Northampton on 56 points. And play Exeter away. Harlequins are on 55 points, and they play Wasps away. Who will qualify?
What about Wasps though? They need something, don't they? They can still get into Europe, do they?
There's a European issue.
So Wasps have got something to play for.
Wasps do have something to play for. Yeah.
Well, Exeter. You know, it's interesting. Very unusual situation they're in. They qualified ages ago. They are struggling. I mean, I was down there for the Harlequins match recently, and they probably should have lost it. Certainly could have lost it. And, you know, Rob Baxter admitted afterwards, he called it an emotion vacuum. And he's concerned, and I don't think he's wrong to be, that what if we can't rediscover the way we normally play when it matters? And so they are vulnerable, and I think if Northampton really want to win that game, which quite clearly they do, they could win it.
I think Exeter will win. I do think they will recover it. And I think at home, they've rotated. They've been waiting for the playoffs, but it's really psychologically, I think they'll be up for it, which I don't think they have been for the last few weeks for a whole load of reasons. You know, you look at it now, three games to go, they'll be saying to themselves, the first one, and we hope, and then we hope the first two, well, no, the first two at our, on our own patch. Right, we got
to
get going.
Yeah, but do you it's not think time. They've been saying that the last few weeks as well?
Well, I mean, I think they might have been saying it.
The bottom line is they don't have to win it.
I'm not. I'm sure they've been saying it, but I'm not sure they believe it.
Well,
I think
why
now
they suddenly believe it now?
They also don't have to play all their best players, do they?
They will. I'd be really surprised if you this weekend. I could be wrong, of course. I'd be really surprised if you don't look down the extra run-on team and go. That's the A squad, that's the A team, that's the semi-final team. Quinn's at Wasps. I think Quinn's are a bit more than the sum of their parts. I mean, because you go through the team and you look at certain bits, you know, both their first-choice wingers are injured and you think, but actually they're pretty cussed and they're pretty sort of, they hang in to games.
So they're everything they weren't last season.
Correct.
And the season before that.
And I think they will just narrowly scrape a win at the Rico. I may be being accused of Quinn's biased here because, you know, they are still...
No, I think...
You're beloved.
Yeah,
I think
they
Wasps
are,
have
they
an
are.
Ability to lose games this season.
How did they lose that game at Bath? I mean, but no, I think, yeah, if you push me, I think Quinn's will get fourth slot.
Okay. I'm going to go Northampton.
Okay. All right, well, that's what we like, a bit of debate. And okay. we, as usual, finish on our God or Goddess of the Week, your favourite, whatever.
Well, I wanted to say Alex Good because I love him.
Okay, go on then.
But actually, I'm going to say, even though I absolutely don't know him, Mickey Steele-Bodger.
Oh, good show.
Well done, you.
And also a nod.
You have to explain who you're talking about.
Sorry, he's the 94-year-old, was he? President of the Barbarians, the man who invented the Barbarians and came to symbolise it more than anyone else. And of course, Barbarians rugby comes to symbolise something that, you know, we might call nostalgic again, you know, the flamboyant way
just
of
just wrapping up every theme on this podcast.
Every theme. Anyway, what? Poor old chap. And the other thing he represents, he's a hero to me because he is renowned for his drinking and he lived to be 94. There's hope for us all. So he died last week and so I'll make him my God of the Week.
I feel I'm going through the motions here and I'm not going to win this week. I'm going to say, because I occasionally do choose inanimate objects, as you know, and I'm going to say the City of Newcastle.
Oh. Three.
Do you know what? That's what I was going to say as well.
So
you're out voted 2-1.
I am obviously biased.
I seriously was going to say that.
I am obviously biased because I worked on the project, but I say working with Newcastle City Council and other people in the Falcons and Mick Hogan and his team, and that I wasn't running it, I was helping them, and they took the risk. You know, just great people to work with. It was a great event to work on, and I just love the fact that probably for the first time since maybe since the Middlesex Sevens almost, walking around the city, it was like the rugby tribe that I belonged to. That it wasn't just Leinster fans and just Saracens fans. They were there. There were people there from all over Great Britain and Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic and some French. It was just a great celebration of this strange little game that we're all partly obsessed with.
Well, I was going to say Newcastle as well because I thought it was a magnificent weekend and I thought they were terrific hosts. And as we discussed beforehand, if the RFU could be or PRL could be persuaded to take the Premiership final up there 1 year or two henceforth, then I think that would be a magnificent job.
But we'll go back to Newcastle. I don't think Mickey Steele-Bodger will pass away again.
Mickey Steele-Bodger is our God of the Week. And,
yeah,
and with that, we bring this to a close. Mike, Mark, thank you very much again.
That was really interesting coming on.
Unholy Union out in September. The Ruck's out this afternoon. And it's out again next week as well. Thank you, everyone out there, for listening. Back again next Monday. See you then.
As As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.